And for our last announcement, our new office administrator, Nadia Kozak, will be starting this week on Wednesday, March 1st. We thank you in advance for being patient, friendly, and helpful as she learns the job. And Reverend Shauna, who has served as supervisor, will now lead us in honoring our retiring office administrator, Karen Udall Ekman.
Good morning. I need to acknowledge that this is a moment of transition in our community. As you may have noticed, sneaking in next to the piano, as she rarely does, was Karen Udall Ekman after I convinced her to be here for this moment. Karen has ably served our congregation for 9.5 years now in the role of office administrator. And it's a role that has a job description, but Karen does much more than what it says on paper she does. And I was keenly aware and reminded of that yesterday when we celebrated the life of Menno Trump here in the sanctuary, and Karen was here. Was it in her job description to be here yesterday for that memorial service? No, it wasn't. But Karen had a sense that it would be good for her to be here, to be present, to answer questions of the family, to be a warm and welcoming presence, and I know that throughout the time that I've worked alongside Karen, it's that caring, that sort of above and beyond the job description, caring about people that she does so well and that we will miss so much as she retires and moves on to new things. You guys can ask her about what she plans to do, but I've heard about the potential purchase of a Reiki table, and Karen is an illustrator. She's got lots of talents and skills that have been kind of on the back burner while she's been administrating here. And so I have some gifts. Karen, if you would come over just for a minute. I know, I just want you to move to the middle just for a minute. Oh, it's so hard. So hard. I'm not going to make her say anything. But, yeah. Now, one of the things that I know many of you will always remember about Karen is that sometimes when she would send us the e-weekly, when she used to send it, and when she would send us the newsletter, she'd send these beautiful descriptions of what was going on outside across the way there. And so as one of our parting gifts to Karen as she leaves us, although she may come back, is a painting that Betty Sherwood has painted of that view out the window. So you have an image of it up there, and I'm giving it to Karen here. Look at this beautiful painting that Betty has made, and it's called, it has a title, Across West Saanich Road. So this is, isn't that gorgeous? Where's Betty? There she is. She's right there. She's in the third row. It's gorgeous. And so if you ask Karen later, you might get to see the real thing because it's much better than just than that photo will do justice there. And then we also have an album of sort of memories and recollections and gratitudes that we would like to present to you to read on at your leisure and with a good cup of tea. And we want to just thank you for all of your hard work. Oh, and Mary Kramer has pictures in here, too, that I need to show in the book. Well, but I can't really show them to everybody right now. They won't really appreciate them. So you can come ask Karen to come see the pictures that Mary Kramer put in her book. So thank you, Karen, for all of your hard work. And now we'll let you go.
We are going to play a little game. I've asked three contestants to help me. We've got Dan, Shauna, and Chris up there. Thanks. So this is the game. Three contestants. The game is whoever gets to this bowl, basket of banquet of pretend fruit first wins. I'm going to put that there so they can reach it. All right? They are all smart people. They are all hard workers. In this game, their fate will be determined by a roll of the dice. Would someone please roll the die to determine how many steps Reverend Shauna is going to take Amelia? Oh, that's nice. Blow on it. She's having her friend blow on it for luck. Oh, six. Two more. There you go. Six. And would someone please roll the die for Dan? What is it? One. Oh, thank you very much. And would someone please roll the die for Chris? Thank you, Flora. Five. Thank you very much. All right. Shauna, can you reach the bowl? The winner is Shauna Lingood. All right. Now stay there. Now, this is just a game. But what if it was real? Remember, I said that they were equally smart and equally hardworking. Why should one get the whole basket of food when the others get nothing just because of luck? I hear that today, in Children's Chapel, the Questers will be leading a worship service on poverty and homelessness. And then you're all going to get to help bake cheese bread and a treat called fiddle diddles for the homeless youth who are served by the Out of the Rain shelter. I wonder if people who are homeless sometimes feel like Chris or Dan in our game. No food because of dumb luck. Sometimes bad things happen to people through no fault of their own, and when that happens, we Unitarian Universalists try to share what we have and help where we can, just like you are going to do when you bake for the Out of the Rain youth. What do you think Shauna might do to help Dan or Chris? Way back there, go ahead. You thought she was going to eat it all. He said she thought she was going to eat it all. What else could Shauna do that would be more equitable?
Share it?
Yes, like share it. Would you share some, please? There we go. That's what we do as Unitarian Universalists. We share. Thank you. Okay. Thank you for listening. Athena will carry the children's chalice to Children's Chapel. Some of you are aware that this is our last, Shauna and my last Sunday here with you. And as each of you are coming up and lighting candles, I got all nostalgic and teary and like, I'm going to miss you guys. And we both are going to be holding your joys and sorrows and worries and concerns all the way through. And we look forward to coming back and asking you how you are. Each one of us here is a complex mix of various identities: race, ethnicity, nationality, gender identity, sexual orientation, class, and more. In our UU congregations, we welcome you as your whole self. That's what makes our community rich and vibrant and able to do good in the world. We share the gifts that come with each of our multifaceted identities. Maybe because of one of the facets of your identity, you've been hurt or insulted, disrespected or overlooked, underestimated or misunderstood, been made to feel like you are less than, unworthy, or don't fit. This meditative hymn rejects any such degradation and sings the truth. Let's remain seated and sing meditatively. We'll sing and then we'll join together in a minute of silent reflection Let's breathe in and breathe out. Blessed be.
At some point in my youth, I became aware of our family's place in our community. In our hometown, a suburb of Los Angeles in the 1960s and 70s, the price of real estate escalated the closer a property got to the San Gabriel Mountains and declined the further south one went. It was kind of a joke among friends that those who lived south of Duarte Road were on the wrong side of the tracks. But we who lived in the middle, north of that line, but south of Foothills Boulevard, were seen in the same way by those on the north side. And while it was not certainly universally true, I did indeed feel somewhat looked down upon by some kids because of where we lived. Now, while my father's income could have certainly supported us living north of Foothills, the fact that my parents grew up on a Wisconsin farm during the Depression guided them to scrimp and save as if that were not the case. Outward displays of wealth were discouraged, so we lived in a modest house on a modest street, took modest vacations, and drove modest cars. I think a form of classism also showed up for me in our religious community. I was taught that the circumstances one finds oneself in are due to the effort, actions, and mostly the beliefs of the individual, and that one who was right with God would prosper and be blessed. This belief stood, and for some still stands, in contrast with the teaching from Jesus that the blessings of the Father are given to everyone. He causes his Son to rise on the evil and the good and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous, and that we are to bless even our enemies as an act of imitating God, who is kind to the ungrateful and to the wicked. For me, my awareness of my upbringing and this spiritual teaching has led me to cherish are seven principles, in this case the first two, the inherent worth and dignity of every person and justice, equity, and compassion in human relations.
Class and classism. I want to begin by acknowledging that talking about class can be emotionally fraught. Each one of us has come here with our own experiences and feelings about class. Consider your own feelings about the class that you grew up in. How you felt when you became aware that some people had less than you. And how you felt when you became aware that others had more than you. Consider your feelings about your current financial situation, your current class status, and how you interact with those classes different from your own. Money and social status bring up all sorts of emotions: anxiety, envy, shame, guilt, resentment, anger. So let's take a moment to breathe. As Unitarian Universalists, we are committed to learning about and working against all the stereotypes and prejudices that divide our society and divide us. Despite whatever uneasy feelings the topic may evoke, you showed up for a sermon on classism. Thank you. Let's be gentle with ourselves and each other as we explore this complex and emotionally loaded issue. Class is complex. Just figuring out which class you're in can be complicated. First of all, it is a multifaceted construct. Our class, our socioeconomic status, is based on a number of different factors, right? There's income, education, housing situation, type of work skills, the amount of control a person has over one's own work schedule, whether one is supervised or supervises others, the depth of resources one has to fall back on in the case of job loss or health crisis. Secondly, class categories are named and defined differently by different people. There are the colloquial terms: poor, working class, middle class, upper class, rich. Activist and sociologist Betsy Leonard Wright offers these categories: chronic poverty, working class, lower middle class, professional middle class, and owning class. I had to look up what owning class meant. It means it's people whose families have enough income from investments and assets that they don't have to work to pay basic bills. Complicating things further is the fact that many people have, over a lifetime, moved from one class to another, and yet another sometimes. And of course, one's class experience is going to be different depending on one's other identities: race, gender identity, immigration status, religion, etc. For example, working class people who are indigenous are likely to have a different experience than working class people who are of European descent. Here's another complicated thing about class. Intuitively, we know that each class has its own culture, but it's hard to put your finger on what exactly those cultural differences are. One researcher isolated 62 distinct subcultures within those four basic categories. Each subculture has its own values and expectations and ways of being. This makes it hard to interact with cultures different from your own in appropriate and respectful ways. Case in point, when I was in seminary, actually taking a year off from seminary, working at a record store, I dated a nurse who had grown up in an Irish Catholic working class family. She made more money than I did, but our families of origin seemed a stronger factor in determining our class. Culturally, She was working class, and culturally, I was professional middle class. I remember going with her to a party thrown by a bunch of her college friends who had also grown up working class. I felt completely out of place. It was like I was missing some basic cue cards for how to engage in their conversations. And I made the classic blunder. I used the icebreaker, "So, what do you do for a living?" The question fell flat every time. Later, someone explained to me that in many working class cultures, what you do for a living isn't asked because it isn't relevant. It doesn't often reflect a person's passions and interests. It's just something they do to make a living, and they don't want to spend their time off at a party talking about it. People often make the generalization that Unitarian congregations tend to be upper middle class. When Unitarians merged with Universalists in 1961, they got a good influx of working class folks also. But it seems to remain true that our current Unitarian Universalist culture retains many of the hallmarks of professional middle class culture. I read somewhere that as a culture group, UU culture lines up well with that of L.L. Bean customers. I'm not sure what that means exactly. As I say, the slippery categories. Perhaps it's some combination of characteristics like college-educated, socially progressive, CBC listening, prone to drinking fancy coffee drinks, concerned about the environment, travel for fun, and able to afford L.L. Bean outerwear. To be clear, that may describe UU culture, but it does not describe all UU people. In fact, people in our congregations are wide-ranging in our class backgrounds and experiences. We have among us people who have all different kinds of educations: high school, trade school, grad school, the school of life experience. We have among us people with all sorts of job experiences and job loss experiences, housing experiences, and home loss experiences. We have people from the full range of the economic spectrum, including folks who have moved on that spectrum, people who grew up with less and now have more, people who grew up with more and now have less. We have diversity among us, but our culture is still predominantly professional middle class, which can make it hard for some people to feel like they fit in. A website called uuclassconversations.org encourages people to share their class journeys. Here is an excerpt from one written by Reverend Dorothy Emerson. She writes, "I was born during World War II in Long Beach, California. My father, who dropped out of school at age 14 to work, had a steady job with Union Oil, but his lack of formal education meant he never got paid what he was worth. My mother, who finished college after becoming a nurse, worked outside the home while I was growing up. I usually define my background," she says, "as lower middle class. What was difficult for me about our class was that once we moved from the city to the suburbs, almost all my friends and classmates had bigger houses, their own rooms, mothers who stayed home and baked cookies, and some had swimming pools. Each year they had the latest styles of new school clothes, while mine were last year's bought on sale. As the oldest child, at least I got new clothes. My sister often wore hand-me-downs. Thanks to a good scholarship, I went to Pomona College, a small liberal arts school with a great reputation. However, I sometimes felt out of place, like everyone else was smarter and richer. My first roommate had a drawer full of cashmere sweaters I used to like to touch when she wasn't around. I could never even afford one. During summers and school breaks, many classmates went skiing to Europe while I worked to make money for the next year. After college, I got a decent salary as a teacher and married an artist husband whose income varied. Living in Northern California, I got to know my extended family on my father's side. Typically working class, they were friendly, outgoing, laughed a lot, and talked all at once. I realized I was a lot like them, and I enjoyed being with them. But my more refined husband was horrified. With a college education, I supposed I would be considered solidly middle class even after I married a working class woman. But the feeling that I don't quite fit in comes up more often than I'd like to admit. Living now in cultured New England has been difficult at times. I've had to tone down my sometimes raw, natural spontaneity to adapt to the upper middle class milieu in some UU churches. I find myself more comfortable in groups that are diverse class-wise. I don't fit in either with working class or upper middle class, so diversity helps. It also helps if the group has at least some other extroverts who also talk loudly and energetically. End quote. Here's an excerpt from Class Journey by Denise Graves, age 53. Quote, I was a Unitarian kid raised in Kansas City, Missouri. My father had risen from poverty as a child to provide a middle-class style for a family. My husband and I would now be considered working class. Neither one of us attended college. I have been working in public school food service, the cafeteria, for the past 15 years. Though I now have a management position, I am neither well-respected nor well-paid. I would have to say that I have lived as an adult in a lower income status than I was raised in. From age 20 to 51, I did not attend any UU church. Part of the reason was that I assumed I would now be out of place due to income and education. I have been attending a UU congregation for the past 2 years where I have thought about and raised questions about difference in class and helped to make others feel helping to make others of less income and education feel welcome. End quote. It is worth noting that money and class differences can be awkward for everyone, upper classes too. None of us like to be judged about the way we spend or give away our money. Consider this comment from a Unitarian Universalist congregant in another church. Quote, I was concerned when a member of my congregation's stewardship committee said that if someone could pledge $10,000 to our operating fund, it should be no big deal for her to give another $2,000 to make up the shortfall in our campaign. I felt this assumed that this member had not made any sacrifices to make this pledge and that this person had unlimited resources. End quote. How's everyone feeling? Check in with your discomfort meters. Keep breathing. Speaking of discomfort, have you ever done one of those privilege walk exercises? You stand up in a group, in a circle or a line, and as the facilitator reads a list of privileges based on gender, race, class, and so on, you take a step forward for each privilege that applies to you. Some nodding heads. Oh, yeah, I've done that, they say. Here's a small sample of 6 class-related statements. You can privately participate by silently counting the number of statements that apply to you. 1, when I was growing up, I never had to skip a meal or go hungry because there was not enough money to buy food. 2, neither I nor my parents were ever in foster care or in a residential school. 3, at least one of my parents was a college-educated professional. 4, my association or connection with a friend or family member has helped me to get a job. 5, I have in the past or will likely in the future inherited money or property. 6, I have never been called names because of my race, class, ethnicity, gender identity, religion, immigration status, or sexual orientation. Take a moment to check in with yourself. How did it feel when or if a statement applied to you? How did it feel when or if a statement did not apply to you? One thing I noticed is that when the fuller version of this exercise is done at UU gatherings, many of us who had lots of privileges, myself included, felt kind of embarrassed. No one wants to be outed as the one who has all the advantages. When one was listed that did not apply to me, I felt kind of relieved. Oh, good, I'm a woman. Oh, good, I'm a lesbian. I've mentioned this before, that it's strange that we can feel both embarrassed about having more than others and embarrassed about having less than others. When grappling with such uncomfortable feelings, I try to remember that these privilege points are all based on luck. Whether you have it or not is not your fault. So having privilege doesn't make you a bad person, and not having privilege shouldn't be shameful. It's a roll of the dice. An unlucky roll in privilege can make it really hard to accrue resources. There was an article about privilege on our congregation's Facebook page a while back. Thank you to Sylvia Crow and Jane Wilson for calling that to my attention. Laura Willard of Upworthy.com writes, quote, "Privilege can be a hard thing to talk about. Oftentimes, when it's implied or stated that someone is privileged, they can get defensive or upset. They may have worked very hard for what they have accomplished, and they may have overcome many obstacles to accomplish it. And the word privilege can make a person feel as though that work is being diminished. The key point about privilege, though, is that it doesn't mean that a person was raised by wealthy parents, had everything handed to them, and didn't have to do much other than show up. Privilege means that some of us have advantages over others for any number of reasons that we don't control, like who we are, where we come from, the color of our skin, or certain things that have happened in our lives. Even when things haven't come easy for some people, they can still have privileges that others don't have." End quote. The article showcases this cartoon by Toby Morris. I'll read the print to you. "On a plate, a short story about privilege. This, on the left, is Richard. His parents are doing okay. And this, on the right, is Paula. Her parents, not so much. Richard's house is warm and dry. His shelves are full of books, and his fridge is full of food. Paula's house is full of people and not much else. It's damp and noisy, and she keeps getting sick. Richard's parents will do anything for their baby. Good boy, says the father. Clever, says the mother. And so will Paula's. That's why they're working two jobs. Richard goes to a great school, well-resourced, good kids. His teachers love their job. At Paula's school, the class sizes are large, the school is underfunded and looks it. Her teachers are tired, stretched thin from the stress. The teacher is thinking, oh man, I need a new job. So maybe we can see why the expectation set for Richard, mom says, B+? Oh dear, we need to get you a tutor. The expectation set for Richard might be slightly different than those set for Paula. Her mom says, B, hey, not bad. And over the years, all these little differences, Richard, parents paying for university, Paula, juggling work and polytech, still getting in debt, all these little differences, they start to add up, to build into something bigger. Richard's dad says, I have friends working there. I'll have a word and get you an internship. Thanks, Dad. Paula's dad, in a hospital bed, another unlucky roll of the dice, says, you should be finishing your studies, not looking after me. She says, Dad, you're sick. And because each little difference sneaks by unnoticed, Richard is told, "Yep, the loan is approved. Congratulations." Paula is told, "Look, we just can't help you. Maybe try easy finance." Then maybe Richard starts to believe that he deserves to be on top, that he did it all himself. Richard's boss says, "Oh, you're Roger's boy, right? I've heard good things. Keeping my eye on you." And maybe Paula starts to settle, learns to know her place. Paula's boss says, "Okay, you've got the job, but I'm watching you, sweetie." But I hope not. The banner says, "Congratulations, Richard." At the same party, Paula is working as a server. Someone at the party asks Richard, "What's the secret to your success?" Richard replies, "Less whining, more hard work, I say. I'm sick of people asking for handouts. No one ever handed me anything on a plate." As Paula hands him hors d'oeuvres on a plate. And the narrator repeats, "I really hope not." The illustrator says this, "I'm not trying to say that I'm against the idea that if we work hard, we succeed. I would like to think that that's true for the most part. But I just think people often forget or don't realize that our starting points or our paths to success are not all even. Some people have to overcome more obstacles in the path to succeeding than others." End quote. In my research for this sermon, two classes stereotypes kept coming up again and again. We just delved into the first one, the myth that low-income people are lazy, that they are stuck in their situation because they are not willing to work hard enough. The other stereotype to work at debunking in ourselves and society at large is the myth that lower-income and working-class people are not smart. This is, of course, ridiculous. Not everyone has the money to pay for formal education, but intelligence can be found in all classes. In the book Thinking Class, author Joanna Cady, who grew up working class, writes, quote, "Stupid. They marked my family as stupid, and this confused me. My aunt went from grade school education to being the neighborhood CPA. She knew all the deductions, could add numbers ridiculously quickly, and did everyone's taxes for free. My grandfather, literate in three languages, poor, steered Lebanese immigrants through the morass of landlords, bosses, and lawyers. My fathers and uncles, with their 10th grade educations, filled out daily crossword puzzles with pens and painstakingly planned, calculated, measured, added rooms on small houses with wiring, plumbing, support beams, ceilings, floor tiles, never a 16th of an inch out of place." End quote. If we want to work toward a much more just society in coalition with people from all classes, if we want to live our first principle, it's good to be aware of the stereotypes that are out there and to notice the ones we've absorbed when they rear their heads. Stereotypes about low income and working classes. Also the stereotypes of professional middle class as snobby elitists and the stereotypes of rich people as greedy and heartless. We need one another to do this work. The more we get to know one another's stories and experiences, the more readily we are able to think from perspectives that are not our own and learn to be intentionally inclusive of a wider range of people. Our congregations have already started expanding beyond the confines of that professional middle-class culture to which we have been limited. We are learning not to ask what people do for a living as a conversation starter. We have modified youth bridging ceremonies. Instead of announcing where each youth is going to college, we ask youth to tell us about the Unitarian Universalist values they bring with us into young adulthood. We are getting better at offering programs and events by donation instead of at a fixed price. We talk about pledging goals in terms of percent of income rather than flat amounts. We are encouraging a culture of ride sharing. We are working toward paying living wage for our employees. And our Social Responsibility Coalition works on addressing immediate needs as well as systemic issues that contribute to economic justice in our city and in our world. I'll end with this. Whatever your own socioeconomic status, if you have ever felt in this congregation marginalized or snubbed or just uncomfortable because of your money situation or your class background, I want to say out loud, thank you for being here anyway. Your stories, your experience, your presence enriches our whole. The more diverse we are as a community, the better able we will be to fight classism in ourselves, in our denomination, and in the world. So may it be. Our closing words are from Reverend Mark Morrison Reed. The central task of the religious community is to unveil the bonds that bind us to each, that bind each to all. To unveil the bonds that bind each to all. There is a connectedness, a relationship discovered amid the particulars of our own lives and the lives of others. Once felt, it inspires us to act for justice. So may it be.